If you haven't played Paddy Power Fantasy yet, you're missing out. But on the upside, if you haven't played it yet, you qualify for a risk-free first go. Get up to £20 back as cash when you play Paddy Power Fantasy. And because every NFL game day is a season in itself, you don't have to wait to find out if you've won. Paddy Power Fantasy. Hate waiting, love winning. New customer offer, min £5, max £20 refund. T's and C's apply. Paddy Power Fantasy rules apply. 18 plus, begambleaware.org.
Hello and welcome to the Nat Coombs Show presented by Paddy Power Fantasy. Good to have you with us as we look back on a chaotic trade deadline day. By chaotic, I mean not a huge amount happened, but we'll tell you what did happen. We'll get into all the big stories that you need to know from a disappointing trade deadline day. Andy Dalton, he's been benched in Cincinnati. Obviously, London didn't agree with him. More on that story as well. We'll talk Mike's top five. We'll get into the mailbag of Ben Isaacs, our college expert, drops by to get you set for a weekend of college action on the ESPN player app, amongst others. So a jam-packed show. Let's get straight into it with Iron Mike. Now, Iron Mike, you know I'm never disappointed when I work with you, right?
I should hope not. No, it's always a lot of fun, isn't it?
It always is. 12 years of counting and still going strong. But I am a little bit disappointed that I was so excited about this show, thinking, brilliant, Wednesday morning, me and the big man getting into all the crazy trade deals done on deadline day. And it's been a bit of a damp squib, hasn't it? Pretty disappointing all in all.
Yeah, I have to say my Wednesday morning movement was a whole lot better than the NFL's Tuesday night movement.
Yeah. Well, let's start with the big story with the Finns, though. They're the big movers in the trade deadline market, picking up Aqib Talib and a fifth round pick going to Miami as well in exchange for a seventh round pick in 2022. What a valuable commodity that is. So.
Yeah, they're going to trade that for two boxes of tape and some Gatorade. This is interesting only in the sense that it's an NBA style trade. This is like the one where Brock Osweiler went briefly to the Browns in exchange for them taking a second round draft pick off of Houston. Miami gets a fifth round pick simply for taking Aqib Talib's salary off the Rams salary cap.
Just over $4 million, that is.
Yeah, and I doubt he actually ever play. He could be back. He was projected to be back by week 15. But if I'm Aqib Talib's doctor, I'm telling you there's no way in the world you come back to play for the Dolphins in the last 2 weeks of this season.
Sure.
You know, and then,
play for, surely.
And then who knows? Maybe they can make him an offer for the next year. You know, maybe he'll buy into Brian Flores's system or something like that. But basically, this is the Rams trying to clear salary cap, not for free agency, which you might have thought, but I think to simply re-sign their own players after the season is over.
Ramsey, most notably, right?
Jalen Ramsey is going to be the big item. And, Brian Hill is now the starting cornerback, and he's no Aqib Talib, as we saw at the game.
Yeah, there's no Marcus Peters either. I mean, interesting shift in the secondary there. Interesting on that, Mike, on your point in terms of the way the Dolphins have approached this. And Tom Pelissero, the NFL.com writer, tweeted out, the Dolphins paid Ryan Tannehill a $5 million bonus to facilitate a trade that got them a fourth round pick. They paid Robert Quinn $1 million bonus to facilitate a trade that got them a sixth round pick. And now they're paying Aqib Talib $4.2 million to get a fifth round pick.
Yeah, which kind of overvalues those picks, you might think. The thing is they've got the money. Right. Their whole roster is heavily underpaid, shall we say. So they have the money to spend, and they picked up a fifth for Kenyon Drake. Mm. So they're going to go in. I think at the moment they've got 14 picks in the draft.
Which does represent quite a significant departure from Dolphins of, the last 10 years plus, who have typically gone down the let's go big in free agency route as opposed to let's try and rebuild.
Yeah, and this is Flores the lessons. They're a New England front office. It's the lessons from the Patriots. And, when you have 14 picks, you obviously aren't going to bring 14 rookies in and start, although the Dolphins will have space for more than most teams do. But it gives you that flexibility to say someone calls you up and says, hey, you've got three first round picks. Mm-hmm. And you say, well, we'll give you one of the, you know, we want one of them. And you say, okay, well, we want, you know, a second and one of yours next year. And we'll give you a fifth and you give us a third, you know, yeah. And all of a sudden you move, you've got these little chips you can use to move yourself gradually into better positions in the draft and get players who really, you know, who really might help you right away.
Yeah, you mentioned Kenyon Drake. Quick line on him going to the Cardinals. Are you surprised at that deal? I mean, Drake has been, he's obviously a running back and a kick returner as well. So he has a spot on, a role to play on special
teams. Yeah, they need him because David Johnson's hurt, Chase Edmonds, who had a great game, you know, pulled a hamstring at the end of the game or early in the game, and so he's out, and so they don't have much in the running back market. And Drake's a good runner. His problem is he doesn't block. Now Cliff Kingsbury can probably get away with that in a lot of his offense without a back who blocks, pass block particularly. But he didn't have much choice. They had to pick up somebody, I think, just to fill that spot. And I wouldn't be surprised if he plays the whole game on Thursday, which will be interesting because Kyler Murray or somebody is going to have to tell him what to do on most of the plays.
All right, let's move on. Jamal Adams was a player who was getting a lot of buzz all day. And, of course, this was typically much like transfer deadline day in the UK in football and European football. There's a lot of buzz flying around and rumors coming out, and often these deals don't get done. But a number of players were, Lev Bell as well, from the Jets, were getting a lot of whispers and a lot of chat, and Jamal Adams seemed to be the strongest, and particularly going to Dallas. That seemed to be the hot rumor for a lot of the day, but it didn't happen. And subsequently, Mike, when the deadline was done and dusted, Jamal Adams said, look, I told the front office, I told Adam Gase I didn't want to go anywhere, but then they were trying to ship me out anyway. So throwing a bit of shade on the Jets front office there, and that has been kind of countered by various journalists saying, well, that isn't the case. They weren't actively shopping him. They were just listening to offers, and there is a albeit subtle distinction.
Yes.
Are you surprised that deal didn't get done, given, you know, Dallas obviously were interested in him. It's a kind of Dallas type move and player, and they're contenders this year.
Yeah, I mean, now I don't take all the reports necessarily seriously. Adam Schechter in one of them, I think it was the Leonard Williams trade, said they were getting a third round pick this year, and I'm thinking, but this year's draft's already over, so that's a neat trick if they can do it. I don't take all the report, but from what I saw, there were other offers besides Dallas, and one of them at least was bigger than Dallas's. Mm. And Joe Douglas supposedly was holding out for a first and 2 seconds based on the Jalen Ramsey deal. Now, Jalen Ramsey's a whole lot more important to a team than Jamal Adams, who's a great player, but he's an in-the-box safety.
Yes.
He's not a pass coverage kind of guy in particular. And the Ravens, I think, were the team that really wanted him, and that would have been a pretty good fit for all concerned.
It was the Ravens that were really happy. But he was connected to the Cowboys too, right?
Yeah, the Cowboys made a serious offer, and okay. and they were the only team that promoted the offer. I mean, that's why I know they were serious. They were saying they were offering it for him. Okay. And he's from Texas.
That connection. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I think Joe Douglas is a pretty shrewd guy, and a player of Adams' quality was only going to go if he could get a real bonanza for him. And he couldn't quite get the bonanza he wanted. Now, whether he overplayed it or not, you know, I doubt that. I think he's being honest. I don't think he felt a need to move Adams. It was simply if someone was offering it, make an offer you can't refuse, you know, from Jimmy Garoppolo or one of those guys, he would have had to go along with it, you know.
I see you talking about the guys behind Jimmy that make Jimmy's going to win the game today. No, Jimmy's
going to win and look at the Jets, you know, in 2008, they took Vernon Golston in the first round.
Right.
You know, 11, Muhammad Wilkerson, 12, Quentin Copels, 13, Sheldon Richardson, 15, Leonard Williams, 19, Quinnen Williams. That's six defensive linemen in the first round in the last 18, in the last 11 years, and five in the last eight. And Quinnen Williams, the only one who's still there, you know. Yeah. And the deal for Leonard Williams, the Giants, I think Dave Gettleman just loves big guys. You know, you think about when he was in Carolina and you know, what he had up front with Kawan Short and Starlo Dolele and all those guys. Mm. He just felt the price was too good to pass up for another big defensive lineman. Cause they've drafted Dexter Lawrence and BJ Hill and Devlin Tomlinson. And they, you know, that's the strong part of their team, just as it is kind of for the Jets.
In 25 as well, Williams. I like that deal for the Giants. It's not the same in terms of the Giants to Jets or vice versa as it is in other sports, Mike. The Rail to Barca or Atleti to Rail or Rangers to Celtic or Liverpool to Everton. You know, Jets fans aren't going to be too far.
They never are.
Yeah. The Giants, right? There isn't that same kind of fizz or edge, is there?
It always starts off with animosity. And then as soon as the player does well for you, it becomes an even better sort of, satisfaction because he's someone lost to your arch rivals.
I guess there was the Favre, Green Bay, Minnesota. With the Jets as the kind of stopover, but that was maybe the tastiest kind of edge I can remember in recent years anyway, in terms of a player going to a hated rival.
Yeah. And, you know, and NFL rivalries, to be fair, are not, you know, they're not local derbies in most cases, the Jets Giants being the exception, except they're in different conferences. So they only play each other in the regular season once every 12 millenniums or whatever. The interesting thing was from the Jets point of view, basically what they got was a fifth round pick because had they let him go, they would have got a third round pick in compensation. Anyway, if he went as a free agent. So they basically simply got something extra and they get the third round pick earlier than they would have got it, in compensation. So I suppose it's win-win for both teams. Although giving the Jets extra draft picks, you know, at least Miami have an idea of what they're doing. You think at least they're clear out and heading in direction. The Jets don't seem to have any idea, to be honest.
Hang on. We clear Rufus isn't around, right? Cause you've mentioned them a number of times.
Exactly.
Conspicuously quiet here.
Yeah. I was disappointed in some of the, lack of movement in the last couple of days because I really did think there would be more action.
We'll get into Lev Bell not going was interesting. Trent Williams, another big story in both senses of the word. So he, of course, been holding out at the Redskins and widely expected to get dealt as well. Didn't. So he's back. Lucky Trent in Washington.
Yeah, talk about shrewd front offices. they could have had a first for him back at the beginning of the season, and they were holding out for more. Apparently, they were putting him out for a couple of lower picks and couldn't get that. You know, it's a big contract. He's coming off an injury. He would be motivated to play, presumably, for anybody except the Redskins.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see. Now he's reported to get his he wants to get his year of service in to make this an NFL season on his record. But the question will be whether they ever activate him or not, because, you know, I think I read somebody suggesting that he has the same doctor as Donald Trump did when he got the bone spurs.
I bet he does. And I'm surprised your team, I know that we joke about how they seem to have a bottomless pit of money, and I don't know how they quite managed to keep on acquiring a talent that maybe the well has run dry, but I'm slightly surprised the Rams didn't look at him, given Whitworth's what, 37 now? So probably in his last year.
And Whitworth hasn't been as effective this year as he has been in the past. I was surprised. I know Cleveland, I think, were trying to get him at one point because Cleveland's got problems on the line and the Bengals do. But if you're a team like the Bengals, I think you have to look for rebuilding, and Trent Williams isn't the kind of guy with his contract that you're going to rebuild around. If you're the Rams and you're trying to keep your own guys, it's a different situation. And how many teams coach linemen up? There aren't a whole lot. that have turned out to be able to do that on a regular basis, which is, I suppose, part of the reason why New England stood pat, because they know their offensive line is not very good. And they can pretty much just get by with it. And I saw an interesting one that Big V was available from the Eagles if someone had wanted him, Vaitai, who played well in that Super Bowl year. You know, and very well against the Patriots, and then wasn't so good when they used him last year. The other one was, of course, tight ends, and everybody thought Tyler Eifert was going to go from Cincinnati probably to New England. And apparently they might have been looking at Hooper as well, but they don't have any cap space.
Austin Hooper, yeah, that's true. Because there were a lot of links with Beckham as well. That was a kind of very buzzy rumor flying around, which seems a little bit improbable.
Well, yeah, but they signed Nick Folk to do the kicking because, you know, David Beckham just wouldn't fit in.
Odell Beckham, Mike, Odell Beckham.
Beckham. Oh, Odell Beckham to the Patriots? Are you kidding me? I mean, you know, do you have any idea of what's going on? Poor Freddie Kitchens. I mean, you know, why? Watch that team. They have no idea. They can't get what they got at the other half of last year. And I think part of it is that Freddie Kitchens has these guys that he has to take care of because he doesn't have the gravitas to be able to just tell them to shut up and do their jobs. And and therefore they can't really run the offense that they ran for the last half of last year when it really was Nick Chubb running and and Mayfield on play action out of the pocket, you know, making plays. Now, you know, it's hard to keep a quarterback out of the pocket for a whole season, but you know, apart from the two fumbles, and that's kind of a big apart for Nick Chubb, but he was running like a monster through the Patriots.
Worrying for the Patriots, the first thing and where about the season really, isn't it?
And where was Odell Beckham? You know, Landry's a great fit for what they wanted to do. Beckham's not such a great fit. He really needs to be on a team where they throw the deep ball a bit more, you know, where it's drop back passing and it gives him some time to get into those one-on-one situations where he can get free. A team like the, I don't know, the New York Football Giants or somebody like that, you know, they should try to get him.
That would be amazing if he went back. You mentioned Nick Folk. He's coming for the Patriots. You've binned off Mike Nugent. Disappointing. Well, I thought it was disappointing because he's always a player that I remember fondly through my career. Matt Bryant, the kicker at the Falcons, and there are lots of reasons for that. I remember you and I doing a game early on in us working together, TV game, where Bryant and his wife heartbreakingly lost a child, a very young infant son, and he went out and played, I think it was the next night, or very soon afterwards as well. So, you know, much like Favre when he played after losing his father and many other, you know, similar stories that players in the face of adversity and just unbearable pain that they must be feeling still, you know, were professional and went out and did that. I always thought of him and always have followed him, I guess, as a result of that.
Yeah.
Not to mention a hell of a player. I mean, the all-time Falcons leading scorer, one of the most reliable kickers year after year after year. But of course, now looks like at his age, what, 44, 45, come to the end of the road.
Yeah, and you know, I half thought because the Patriots cut Nugent, who hasn't been particularly good for them, and I half thought that the Patriots would consider signing him, you know, if only to give Tom Brady somebody from his own generation that he could talk to. But you know, Bryant has been a great kicker, you know, and a really dependable one up until this year. But you remember, he was coming off of injury last year, and he's an interesting character in that he's one of many guys in that NFC South who seem to move between teams in the division. You know, he kicked for Tampa and then he moved to Atlanta, and but also he played for the Iowa Barnstormers in the Arena League, the same team that Kurt Warner played for.
Oh, wow.
He played in the NFL Europe for Frankfurt.
He's an NFL Europe alum.
Yeah.
I'm glad you mentioned that, actually. You reminded me of something on Facebook somebody asked us about. I'll bring it up. But, yeah, sorry.
Yeah, and he also played for the Florida Tuskers in between, you know, in between Tampa cut him, and before Atlanta signed him, he had that spring with the Florida Tuskers in the whatever it was called football league.
Yeah. AFL was it?
His coach was Steve Spurrier, I think, if I remember correct. But the United Football, it was called the United Football.
The UFL. God,
the UFL.
UFL. I totally forgot about
it. God, I can remember him in the team, and I can't remember the league name. I'm as old as Matt Bryan.
UFL. God, yeah.
That's so anyway, the Falcons signed Young Ho Koo.
You got that.
Who you remember started with the Chargers and bombed out.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And he was on the Patriots practice squad when they signed Nugent. They signed him at the same time as sort of a backup plan. But I think they'd let him go before that. I think he was just out there on the street. So they've got Young Ho Koo, and the Patriots have Knout like folk. And everybody's happy at least for a week, you know, and Vinatieri, look at Adam Vinatieri this week. And he's what, 44
older,
now?
He must be older.
45. And Vinatieri missed an extra point and a 45-yard field goal and then kicked a 51-yarder to win the game at the buzzer for the Colts. So, you know.
He's 46, Mike.
He's 46.
He's 47 in December.
There we go. So, wow. You know. Yeah, because he's another guy. I mean, I remember interviewing him in 96, I think, when he was playing for the Amsterdam Admirals, and he was both punting and kicking for the Admirals. And he had just, you know, a great story from, you know, I said, how did you end up South Dakota? And he said, that's where my family's from. And he was just lucky that when they went out on that patrol or whatever it was, that they left the band behind. Or else he would have been killed. He would have been killed at Custer's last stand.
Wow.
And he was great. I mean, just the friendliest guy. And, you know, I think that's a sort of a generation of, there were some very good kickers in that generation. Bryant and Vinatieri are two of the best.
Two in that. Now, you mentioned NFL Europe. I'm going to dive just quickly to our mailbag, a sneak peek into our mailbag via Facebook at the NC Show. If you want to follow us on social internetly, and the boys put a whole load of extra content up there all through the week, you know, news stories that you need to be across, and video that we're making as well. So lots of bonus stuff flies out there. So go and give us a follow if you haven't already. This is from Andy Robson. Thanks for this, Andy. Says, Nat, thanks to you and I, Mike, for mentioning NFL Europe on the podcast last week. You may be interested to learn that the Steelers Benny Snell is the son of the former Scottish Claymore running back Ben Snell.
Wow, that one has passed me by. Boy, that makes me feel old. Their kids are coming in. It was interesting. I know you mentioned this little video I made on Sunday, and one of the things I didn't get to put in the video because I was editing in my head as the on air time got closer and closer, and Nat's frantic banging on the door. You know, let me in. We're going on air. But we played against three guys who went into the NFL, one of whom was Doug Swift, who started for the Dolphins in 72 on the undefeated team. But another one was Freddie Scott at Amherst, and Freddie Scott played in the NFL, and so did his son, Freddie Scott Jr. And that was a few years ago. And just thinking about that made me feel old, because pretty soon Freddie Scott 3 is going to come in.
Will Fuller.
Yeah.
It's going to be there before you're done. Let's quickly talk about Andy Dalton getting benched, Mike. He obviously had a difficult time on Sunday. He showed, you know, it was textbook Dalton in the pregame show. Me, you, OC, and Jay were talking about the, you know, Dalton is the prototype of, you know, of the mixed bag quarterback. Sometimes he's great, sometimes he's bad. And he hasn't been getting a lot of help this year, of course, with a fractious and a banged up offensive line, no running game for most of the season, no AJ Green. So he's had a difficult time of it. Is it fair that they've benched him and brought Ryan Finley in, do you think?
Fair, probably not, but it's what you have to expect. It's a little earlier than I thought they might, because putting a rookie in these circumstances is a risky move, not because you worry about wins or losses because you're 0-8, but because you don't want him to develop bad habits. You don't want him to become gun shy. You don't want him to become sack shy. And we think of Carr in Houston, sure. Josh Rosen in his, you know, first 2 years in the NFL. It's nice to be able to bring a quarterback in a situation. Look at Daniel Jones, for example. You know, I think I said when we were off camera during the show when you were reading, or maybe I think I squirted it into the conversation. You know, Daniel Jones was having the kind of day Eli could have had. He makes big plays, he makes mistakes, and that's sort of the case with Dalton. Although the big plays are a bit further apart, and they didn't lose the game because Andy Dalton played badly. They lost the game because their defense was stunk the joint up, was unbelievably bad, you know, was comically bad at times with guys falling down,
sliding over running into each other,
not knowing their assignments and stuff like that. And to me, that's the bigger problem. You know, it's not the quarterback position. And yeah, I suppose you want to find out what you've got with Ryan Finley. But you know, I suspect that by the end of the season, the Bengals may win a couple of games, but you won't be any more convinced one way or the other because you haven't had a real good chance to see your quarterback in a good situation. And you can't ask any quarterback, apart maybe from Archie Manning, to play an entire career on teams with bad offensive lines.
You know? Oh, my poor Archie. Okay, let's you want to talk about Willie Brown, don't you? The great Willie Brown who passed away last week, 78, Hall of Famer, three-time Super Bowl winner, of course, part of that brilliant Raiders team. One of the greats, Mike. Tell us more.
Yeah, I mean, the thing with Willie Brown is he came from Grambling University when in the early days of the AFL, when they were looking, when the traditionally black colleges became a major feeder for the NFL because they'd relatively been overlooked since Tank Younger, who was the first one to join an NFL team, came along. And they started to realize there was an awful lot of talent that just wasn't playing on the big stage because of segregation, in the South, you know, and I have Duffy Doherty's famous quote when he retired as Michigan State's coach. They said, why are you retiring now? And he said, I'm retiring because, Alabama's going to let Bear Bryant recruit black players. So there's no point in hanging on. Yeah. But anyway, so he got cut. Houston signed him. He wasn't drafted, but AFL drafts were kind of a casual thing in those days anyway. And he went to Denver and became all league, and then Oakland got him, and he had like 10 years with Oakland where he was just brilliant. So, you know, between being all AFL and all NFL, I think he's got like 4 first team and 4 second team all league choices, which is certainly a Hall of Fame resume. But his big play came in Super Bowl 11 when he intercepted Fran Tarkenton. And this was a great Super Bowl. It was the one where Art Shell and Willie Upshaw, Gene Upshaw, destroyed the right side of Minnesota's defense, Jim Marshall in particular, at defensive end.
Art Shell, of course, went on to be Raiders head coach, right?
That's right. And Upshaw became the head of the Players Association. Mm. And, you know, so they had good, Shell actually had a good year as head coach and got fired, which is another story. But, so in that Super Bowl, that was kind of the play that, sealed the Super Bowl. And there's a great article by Dan Jenkins from Sports Illustrated about it. And he said, he was talking about all the improbables in this game. The best one was the kicker. The Raiders kicker was Errol Mann. He missed a field goal and 2 extra points in that Super Bowl, and they still won. And Dan Jenkins wrote, Errol Mann kept aiming at the Ventura Freeway instead of the uprights in the Rose Bowl. But anyway, his point with Willie Brown was Willie, a guy who can't outrun anybody except John Madden and Fran Tarkenton. But luckily, Tarkenton was the only one he had to outrun on the 75-yard interception return. That was an NFL record. And then he worked for a long time with the Raiders front office, you know, and all around.
Wasn't he? I think still involved with the Raiders organization, you know, when he died. I think he was.
Yeah, those were the days, you know. Al Davis used to keep people he liked and around, you know, and people he could quote-unquote work with. And Willie Brown was one of those. But he was a great cornerback. and certainly deserved to be mentioned.
Yeah, well said, and raising a glass to him. Right, time for your top five, Mike. Top five coaches who've never won a Super Bowl.
Well, you know, that's an interesting one because simply because you have to only consider coaches from the Super Bowl era. So there's some guys from earlier in the 60s, say, who you might consider aren't there. And of course, all of the great coaches who won NFL championships and stuff like that, aren't considered. So the top five, there's a bunch of guys who just missed the cut as ever. Most notably Dan Reeves, strangely enough, Denver and Atlanta. Yeah. And Chuck Knox, who's one of my personal favorites, was pretty successful as a head coach, but 7-11 in the playoffs. And that tends to be the pattern. Reeves had a winning record in the playoffs, but couldn't win the Super Bowl.
Was Reeves head coach of the Atlanta team that went to the Super Bowl?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And Don Coryell, who was one of the great innovators as a coach and very good in the regular season, but 3-6 in the playoffs. So that's a formula there. So at number five is Marv Levy. And Levy should really get bonus points because he went to three Grey Cups and won it twice, with the Montreal Alouettes in the years when I was living in Montreal, and they were a tremendously entertaining team. But, you know, he was 11-8 overall in the playoffs, but everyone remembers the four straight losses in the Super Bowl that the Bills had, and getting to the Super Bowl 4 years in a row is quite an achievement.
Absolutely. And these Bills teams as well. I mean, the Bills teams that he had were extraordinarily good. I mean, I think, you know, they went into at least one of the Super Bowls as the heavy favorites, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They were great offensively. They had a really good defense, which people tend to forget now, but it had been put together. This was the first of Bill Polian's great teams. And probably in some ways the best of them. On both sides of the ball. And their offense, the K-gun offense, owed a lot to the CFL. It was that kind of wide open play that you do in the CFL because you only have three downs.
Right.
So you do have to, you know, go for first downs. And interestingly, I didn't realize this. I had forgotten it, but he coached in the USFL for the Chicago Blitz in 1984, before he joined Buffalo. So between CFL and Buffalo and some college work.
Was that when Jim Kelly was in the USFL as well? Or is that where he would have?
He was in the USFL, but he wasn't with the Blitz.
Okay.
Yeah, he was with Houston. At number four is Marty Schottenheimer. 6-13 winning percentage, 200 wins, but 5-13 in the playoffs. This is like Marvin Lewis could be on this list too. 0-7 in the playoffs. But Schottenheimer's problem, I think, in the playoffs was he played one way and you knew what that way was. And so when you're playing in regular seasons, that's fine. But when you get to the playoffs and you're going to meet one or two really good defenses, it always becomes a problem when you can't adjust. He also had some terrible luck, and got fired a couple of times by silly owners who didn't realize what they had. Step forward, Dan Snyder.
Yeah. He got fired after a 14-2 record, didn't he?
Exactly, yeah. And both in San Diego and in Washington, he got unceremoniously dumped when he shouldn't have been. At number three is our current favorite, Andy Reid. Who's another guy with a 611 winning percentage in the regular season. He's 12-14 in the postseason. And Andy Reid can do everything except manage the clock. He's the quickest coach I've ever seen to get away from running the ball, and getting back to let's just throw it all the time. And in the last 3 minutes of 4 minutes of a game, his decisions have almost always been questionable, which is his problem. But he is a good team builder and a really good coach. At number two is George Allen, whose career winning percentage in the regular season is 7-12 in the NFL. And interestingly, he coached the Chicago Blitz the year before Marv Levy did. So when he left the Blitz, Levy took his job. But he's 2-7 in the playoffs. And I'm not quite sure why, although his teams were kind of always based on powerful veteran defenses and maybe not enough offense to go. But he started under Sid Gilman with the Rams, but never really embraced a Sid Gilman-style, Don Coryell-style passing game. And then George Halas hired him as his de facto defensive coordinator, replacing Clark Shaughnessy, who had also been with the Rams, simply because he wanted to figure out how to stop Sid Gilman. So he figured he'd have to bring these guys in. Sure. And Allen was also the draft guy for George Halas. So Ditka and Gale Sayers and Dick Butkus all came from Allen's drafts. But like Bill Walsh in Cincinnati, you know, the old boss had promised him or intimated that he should have the head coaching job. And when he wasn't going to get it, when Halas was voted coach of the year again, he just took off and, you know, went somewhere else. But the winner is a guy I have a lot of respect for. His regular season record isn't as impressive as Allen's, and he's famous for losing Super Bowls. 621 winning percentage, which is pretty good in the regular season. 10-12 in postseason. Bud Grant from the Vikings. And Grant produced some good teams that, you know, just managed to find ways to lose. A tough coach, purple people eater defense, Fran Tarkenton, Joe Capp, both got him to the Super Bowl. I put him up at number one partly because if you add in his CFL career, he's got 290 wins overall and a bunch of Grey Cups with Winnipeg. And, you know, famously in Minnesota, he wouldn't let the players use hand warmers because he figured. That's right. If he figured that they could play in Canada without hand warmers, they could play in Minnesota without hand warmers. But Bud Grant was a tremendous athlete. He's a professional basketball player as well, a football player of great note, and I think a really well respected coach. Players loved him. He was tough, but you know, fair. And I just think he's the number one coach who should have won a Super Bowl but never did.
Love it. Quack and work, Iron Mike, and keep those requests coming in for Iron Mike's top five at the NC show. If there is a subject you want Mike to cast his eyes over, that is the way you get in touch with us. Speaking of which, one for the road, Mike. This is from Andy Gilder, who's got in touch with us via Twitter. Appreciate the question, Andy. A quick question on the onside kick rules. Does the NFL mandate the use of the kicking tee?
Well,
or can it be a rugby style drop? It's almost impossible. He says, just quickly, it's almost impossible to recover under the current rules. Just wondered why more teams don't use the extra hang time of a drop kick.
Well, there's two reasons. I mean, the first answer is yes, you don't have to use the tee. But when Justin Tucker did that exaggerated drop kick, the quote unquote competition committee immediately banned it, which puzzles me quite a bit because it's perfectly legal. And, you know, now you're reinterpreting the rules. The problem with drop kicking in the NFL is that the ball has a much more pointed edge, than a rugby ball. And it's much tighter, harder, and has a much smaller sweet spot than a rugby ball. So it's a lot harder to get a drop and kick that you can control, as well. Because, you know, we've talked about this before. I agree that especially the way you have to line up now on onside kicks, the hanging ball in the air is probably a better bet than the squibber along the ground. But most NFL kickers try to get the hanging ball by bouncing it, kicking it off the tee and getting it to bounce high off the turf. And the NFL obviously wants to do away with kickoffs altogether.
Right.
You know, for safety reasons, they say, although onside kicks don't produce all that many injuries as far as I've seen any studies.
About this on the show on Sunday, I think, that do you remember the Jason Sanders kick that Buffalo returned for a touchdown? It was quite a decent onside kick, I thought. I mean, that's one of the better ones I've seen this season.
Yeah. And, you know, they are open to return more because of the way the alignment puts an extra player up front, which gives the receiving team more players to, block out the coverage team, which is, you know, which is what you want to do. If the kick comes high, you want to put them down. And when the coverage team comes down, they're trying to knock players over, who might well be able to recover the ball. So I think it leaves that more open. I remember Bobby Dell returning an onside kick for a touchdown for Kansas City, which I thought at the time was like the greatest play I'd ever seen. But I was young and inexperienced then. But I think, you know,
with Betty Snell watching.
Yeah, without the onside kick, if you're down by two scores and around the 2 minute mark, it's really difficult for you to be able to come back. You know, you can get a score. You might even be able to get the ball back. But the odds of you getting the ball back are really small. So you then try the onside kick. And now the onside kick recovery is really, really small. And it used to be that if you onside kicked by surprise, like the Saints did in the Super Bowl against the Colts, start of the second half, your percentage of recovery was a lot higher than in the situation at the end of the game where they knew you were onside kicking. But now you have to declare you're onside kicking, so you can't run a surprise onsides.
Right.
And I think that's a huge loss to coaches as well, because and to fans, because that's a hugely exciting play.
Well, plays you've seen that the most exciting, the Sean Payton onside Super Bowl kick for me is right up there. Extraordinary.
Yeah. And it caught everybody by surprise. And the gamble is what makes it, you know, so memorable. You know, oh God, if he had missed it, think of what the mouth clowns would have been doing on Twitter. You know, they would have been going crazy.
Twitter would have shut down, I'm sure. Mike Krakenwerk, I will see you Sunday at Wembley Stadium.
Okay. I guess I should show up, you know.
It probably would help.
It was such fun.
Great.
I just love doing it with OC and Jason, and yourself. I think there was somebody gave a bad tweet during that week, which I felt compelled to respond to about the NFL show that OC and Jason do with Chappers. And, you know, I think that show itself has started to influence the way other British broadcasters and the BBC, you know, look at their highlights programs and how they put them together. And admittedly, it's aimed at people without necessarily. It's aimed to be able to include people who don't have a depth of knowledge to try to make things easy for them to understand. But primarily, it's entertaining, and that's what the sport's supposed to be about. We can crunch things over and over again. But in the end, I think what we got Sunday, hopefully, was entertaining as well as informative, and that's really what you want to shoot for with sports broadcast.
Couldn't agree more.
It's not a general election, you know.
Thank God for that. No, I couldn't agree more, man. It was great fun, and let's roll around and do it again on Sunday. So I'll see you then, and our listeners, of course, can follow you on Twitter at Carlson Sports and read your stylings, patreon.com/MikeCarlsonFMTE.
Thank you. Yeah. And it was good. I'm on a couple of rolls now, a couple of good weeks picking the games.
Oh, nice. Well, get involved with that. Mike picks all the games on Friday as well. So if you like throwing, just for the sport, shall we say, if nothing else, but if you like trying to find the edge, that's a decent column. I certainly pay close attention to it. And Ollie, our producer, who is a degenerate gambler as well. He loves it too.
I thought he was just a degenerate.
Yeah. He's developed this season since he's worked with us, Mike. See you Sunday, mate.
See ya.
Cracking stuff from Ian. Mike, he'll be back same time, same place next week. Now, before we chat college with Ben Isaacs, a quick shout out to the guys at Touchdown Trips. Go to touchdowntrips.com. If you're planning a trip stateside to watch a college game, maybe Ben will get you in the mood for that, an NFL game, even a high school game, whatever your football tip, Touchdown Trips are the guys for you. Head to touchdowntrips.com. They can create a bespoke trips. They can take you where you want to go in terms of your specific team, whatever you want, including the Super Bowl, incidentally. Check them out and they will look after your stateside football trip. Right. Speaking of which, let's get on to some college business with Ben Isaacs. Hey man, how's life?
I'm fantastic. How are you?
I am all the better, as indeed are our listeners, for having you on the show, man. So we're going to get into a bunch of stuff. Looking forward to some of the games this weekend on ESPN Player. As you rightfully were reminding me and Ollie just before you came on air, the clock change we need to be mindful of, right?
Yeah, that seems to catch people out every season when it comes to the college football. We're always aware that the NFL will be an hour earlier the day after we've changed our clocks. But you've got to remember, the Saturday after that, it's still in effect. So you can get college game day at 2 p.m. And the games will start 3 hours after that. I balled that up.
Amazing. This is staying in. This is so staying in. Go on.
God almighty.
Legend.
Right. The game. Okay, can we do that again?
No, we absolutely can't, Ollie. This is staying in. Come on, the game's
right. The college game day will be on at 1 PM, yes. Not 2 PM.
Right,
and the games, of course, start 3 hours after that. So the earliest games will kick off at 4 PM, not 5 PM. That's the thing to remember. But you don't want to miss college game day either. So make sure you're tuned in at 1 PM for that.
That is clear as mud, Betty. Thanks. Right.
Thanks, no
hopefully
problem.
Adding slightly more lucidity to the top five teams in college football right now. Who are the top five, the big five, the Ben Isaacs power five?
Okay. So these are my top five. These aren't necessarily the AP top five. This isn't necessarily my prediction of what the top five will be when the college football playoff selection committee announces their first team, their first selections, which we'll have in less than a week's time. My number five is Penn State. They're a fantastically balanced team. They're the only one of my five who don't have a star quarterback. It's about to get really interesting for them. They're 8-0. They've got a bye this week, and then they're at Minnesota, who are also 8-0. I don't expect Minnesota to beat Penn State. I don't expect Minnesota to trouble the college football playoff. But when you've got two 8-0 teams playing in November, that's fantastic. Let's say Penn State beat Minnesota. They've then got Ohio State on November the 23rd. Win both of those, and there's a very good chance they're going to be in that top four making the playoffs. And they would probably be the weakest of those four, but no one's going to want to play them. My number four is the national champions, Clemson Tigers. Now, Trevor Lawrence, the quarterback, he's only been okay by his own very high standards. And they've only beaten one good team, Texas A&M. Now, that's not their fault. The ACC, their conference is having a down year, so they've not played as many good teams. But they have blown teams out, with the exception of the one game where they played North Carolina, where they won by 1 point. Every year Clemson has one game where you think, what on earth are they doing? And then every other game they steamroll the teams. I think right now they are an absolute lock for the top four when it comes to the college football playoff, because there's no one on their schedule right now who can beat them. Number three is Alabama. Yeah, it seems weird, Alabama not being in the top two, but like Clemson, the only good team they've beaten is Texas A&M. Tua Tagovailoa is hurt. Now, they were able to win last week without him against Arkansas, and that's fine. They've got a bye this week so they can get him healthy, because then they're going to play LSU, which is going to be one of the games of the season. Wow. And they finish, as always, against Auburn, and Auburn are a really good team. So Alabama have kind of got the opposite problem that Clemson have. Clemson have got no one to impress us with. Alabama have got really tough games. My number two is LSU. Now, they're number one in the AP poll, but they're my number two. Three times this year, they've beaten a team that was ranked in the top 10 in the week of the game. That's a pretty big deal. They've beaten Texas, Auburn, and Florida, all while they were on a high. Joe Burrow, I don't want to say he came out of nowhere, but nobody expected him to be a star quarterback. And he's making a lot of noise. People think a potential Heisman winner, a potential first-round draft pick. We shall see. He's been super impressive, 30 touchdown passes in 8 games. He's the first SEC quarterback to do that since 1997. Just giving you the context there, that this isn't something that happens every season. Even Tua Tagovailoa hasn't done that. They've got a high-scoring offense with a really nasty defense. So, you know, what's not to love? Grant Delpit, who's a safety for LSU, he's going to be a high draft pick, and he is someone who wide receivers want absolutely no part of. He is a game wrecker. Love this LSU team, but they're not my number one. They're not my number one because Ohio State are my number one. This might be a little bit controversial because LSU have got the most impressive CV, as it were. But Ohio State, to me, they just look better. When I've watched a lot of LSU, I've watched a lot of Ohio State, and Ohio State just look like the best team. They're the most complete team. Justin Fields has been an absolute revelation at quarterback since he transferred from Georgia. He seems completely unstoppable. And they've got the best defensive player in the nation, Chase Young, who he's just like another Bosa. You know, they lost the two Bosas, and all of a sudden they've got Chase Young. It doesn't seem fair. Ryan Day, their head coach, is in his first season there since Urban Meyer retired again, like he did at Florida, kind of controversially just disappeared. But Ryan Day has come in to take over that job, and they've not missed a beat. If anything, they look better. Ohio State against LSU would be an absolutely spectacular championship game. The way that I've got my rankings right now, if they stayed as they are, and it's unlikely because you've got LSU playing Alabama and that's going to affect things, you would have an Alabama-LSU semifinal and a an LSU-Alabama semifinal and a Clemson-Ohio State semifinal. even if those were on at 4 a.m., you should stay up to watch them. This is already now, we're getting to the business end of the season, and I'm really psyched.
It sounds like you are, Betty. So a number of questions for you. So first of all, on this Alabama-LSU rivalry, and inevitably the Joe Burrow versus Tua rivalry.
Hopefully
Tua. And this connects with reports I've read, certainly in the last, I've been aware of them anyway, in the last week or so. You get mock drafts flying around every 30 seconds, seemingly, during the season. And Tua has been number one on mock draft boards for a long old time, but not this week. This week sees the first time I've noticed that some draft leagues are putting Joe Burrow, the LSU quarterback, ahead of him. Is that just for effect and to be a little bit controversial? Do you think it's a very real chance that he might get drafted one overall?
I think it's mostly for clicks, I'll be honest. But the thing is that if Tua is injured and his injury is more serious than we realize, that is going to affect his draft stock.
Yeah.
But there's no player that has as much high quality game film at quarterback as Tua Tagovailoa. There's no suggestion that the injury he's got right now is serious, and I would expect him to play against LSU. But if there is something that's just kind of getting in the way, there will be some coaches who will be a little bit hesitant. But I think he's put enough down for coaches to feel very confident. I would not put Burrow above Tua. I can't imagine that being the situation come April.
Now, what about Jake Fromm at Georgia? He kept out Justin Fields, of course, and he is now flying at Ohio State, as you said. So what do you make of that decision? The right one, the wrong one, in 2020 hindsight?
I think it was right. I think that, Jake Fromm, he came in unexpectedly. He was starting as a freshman because of an injury, and he was able to just take over that team, which he was a true freshman, which means that he had literally been in high school just a few months before. Mm. And then you're playing in front of these crowds of 80, 90,000 people and you are controlling the game. I think it's worked out perfectly for everybody. There's been a lot of transfers that have gone on in the last 12 months, probably more significant transfers in the past year than the 10 years before it. I think it's worked out nicely. It's just kind of these sort of sliding door situations. In the past, you might have had to have Jake Fromm or Justin Fields just kind of rotting away on the bench. But now I was hoping that Georgia would make it to the playoffs because I would love to have seen Justin Fields against Jake Fromm in the playoffs. It's a shame that's not going to happen. I think it was the right decision for both parties, and I don't think that Georgia will have any regrets.
All right, lovely stuff, Ben. Quickly then, games this weekend that we should set our watches to, even if we haven't completely confused the hell out of everybody. So ESPN Player, because of course the great thing about ESPN Player is you can watch pretty much anything you want, right? But what are the ones that you're picking up?
And when you like, which is a godsend, because obviously a lot of those games are on at kind of 1 or 2 a.m. And if you don't want to stay up on the Saturday night, you can just get up Sunday morning. And before you check Twitter, don't check scores or anything. Just you stick it on. You don't have to kind of have any ads or anything. So you can get a game in 2 hours and watch those big games. The two games I'm most interested in this week, Michigan at Maryland, which is at 4 p.m., because I'm so intrigued by Michigan now. I'd written them off like a lot of other people because they lost to Iowa and it just looked like Penn State and Big Ten were going to run. Penn State and Ohio State were going to run away with the Big Ten.
They smashed Notre Dame, and a lot of people fancied Notre Dame for the win, didn't they?
Absolutely. That was such a significant win. They didn't just beat them. They completely controlled that game. A dominant performance, the best Michigan performance I've seen in some time. And I want to see how they do against Maryland now, whether it's a kind of where they have an emotional letdown, it's a potential trap game. I want to see them throttle Maryland so that we know that there is going to be an incredible race within the Big Ten. If you've got Michigan, Penn State, Ohio State, all realistic shots at the college football playoff, then that's good for the game. My other game, 11:30. This might be a bit of a surprise for some people. SMU at Memphis. Neither of these teams are going to be in the college football playoff. Neither of these teams are in what we call the Power Five conferences. However, the Group of Five conferences, the best teams there can get into major, major bowl games as an at-large team. Now, SMU, if you're not familiar, in the 1980s, they were served with the death penalty, which meant the NCAA banned them from playing football for 2 seasons. And the plan was to just completely cripple them. And it has done for decades. Now, the reason this happened was because they were almost openly paying their players and giving high school kids cars to tempt them to join SMU. If you've not seen the ESPN 30 for 30 called Pony Excess, you have to watch that. You can watch that on ESPN Player, of course. You must seek this out. It is one of my favorite college football films of all time. Eric Dickerson, NFL Hall of Famer, hearing him talk about the way that he was recruited by SMU is absolutely amazing. So SMU, this is the best team they've had since the mid-1980s. They're 8-0 for the first time since 1982. Memphis have only got one defeat, a heartbreaking loss at Temple. There's so much prestige for whoever gets one of these big bowl games. So this is a massive step for one of these two teams. I'm hoping it's SMU because I like the idea of SMU being on that national stage because of everything they've been through. And it's just a wild story, Pony Excess, especially those Texas schools, how much they were paying each other. Because SMU, if you don't know, is based in Dallas. And there was so much oil money coming through that area. And it would seem that all those executives would all have gone to schools that were rivals to each other. It could be Texas Tech, Texas, Texas A&M, Houston. And it was an arms race. And there was so much money floating around. SMU have not been the same since. So watch that game at 11:30. But watch Pony Excess before you watch it.
Oh, I love it.
For context.
For the starter, I like that. And are you sure it's 11:30, not 10:30 or 12:30, Betty?
I am going to go with 11:30. Okay. But don't forget, if you don't want to stay up, watch it the next morning.
Okay, it is a done deal. Cracking work, man. At tweets from Ben, if you want to follow Ben on Twitter for all your college startings and more, of course. And he's an all-pro member of our lineup. So you'll be hearing lots more from him, not just on college, but on NFL too, throughout the course of the season. Look after yourself, man.
Cheers, and don't forget to keep an eye on those clocks.
Will do. Lovely stuff from Ben, saluting Iron Mike Carlson. We're back Friday. Tom Deacon in the house. Don't forget, shout out to our terrific sponsors, Paddy Power Fantasy. If you're getting involved with Daily Fantasy, that is the place to go. And we've got a special Daily Fantasy show that drops on a Saturday morning, getting you set for your Daily Fantasy Sunday teams. Remember, you pick a team each and every week. It's not like traditional fantasy where you're stuck with your team for the whole season, which is great if you're 3-5 like I am and not making the playoffs. You can pick a new team every week. There are cash prizes, tournament prizes, all kinds of good stuff there. So get involved. Paddy Power Fantasy. Tom Deacon in the house on Friday. We'll see you then. Bye for now.